Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Together PDX podcast. I'm your host, Elise Gallus, and I'm glad to be back with fresh gospel gathering content for you today. We just had an amazing gathering on discipleship. And whether you are a pastor, work at a church, or just an average person in the pews, I know you are going to find so much rich value in what you're about to hear. Mateus DeCampos is the George F. Bennett Associate Professor of New Testament at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. A native of Brazil, he served for nearly a decade as a pastor in the Church of the Nazarene in Americana, Sao Paulo, and has ministered in South America, North America, and Europe. He came to Portland in late November, and not a lot of people were actually familiar with his work going in, but on the way out, I heard so many amazing reviews of how people loved his points and perspectives and wisdom. I know you'll love it too, so let's dive in. This is part one with Mateus DeCampos, Reframing Discipleship, a Gospel-Centered Paradigm.
We're going to be talking about discipleship today, and normally when I talk about discipleship, it's interesting because the number one question is very pragmatic, how we do discipleship, right? I think I'm going to disappoint you if you came with that kind of perception of what are the things that we have to do. What I want to do is really to spend some time looking at the New Testament, that's my area, and especially at the gospel, and second lecture will be specifically on the Gospel of Mark, and really spend some time looking at what Jesus is doing with the 12. Instead of giving you a model or something to do, I want to present you a paradigm that can be contextualized depending on your needs and the needs of your community. Now, we can have the pragmatic conversations and the more perhaps down-to-earth conversation in the Q&A. But I really want you to bear with me as we journey into the New Testament to look at discipleship within the framework of the Gospels. I won't begin with the Gospels, though. I'll begin with Rembrandt. In 1633, the Dutch artist Rembrandt van Rijn released this painting called Christ in the Storm in the Sea of Galilee. It's based on the famous account of Jesus calming the storm that we find in the Gospels. By the way, this painting, one of my favorite from Rembrandt, it was housed in the Isabella Gardner Museum in Boston. But then in 1990, there was a famous heist and it was stolen. So if you see it somewhere, we're looking for it. The painting is a classic Rembrandt. It is a, he uses light and shadow very dramatically. Interestingly, here he has a dark side of the boat and the bright side of the boat, and Jesus is right here in the dark side, but with his face very calm and illuminated. But Rembrandt's focus in this picture is really on the disciples. He portrays them doing different things. You have some tending the sails, some rowing. There's one there kind of hidden here, praying for his life. And then there is someone here puking their guts out, which would that would be me for sure. But the most interesting feature of this painting is that while you would expect 13 people on the boat, right, Jesus plus 12, when you count them, you actually have 14. There's 14 people. So Jesus and 13 disciples. Now, the extra seems to be this guy here. He is, you know, with his hand on his forehead. He is looking directly at the viewer, kind of breaking the fourth wall kind of moment. And most art critics believe that that's actually Rembrandt himself, based on self-portrayals. So what Rembrandt did here, he really painted himself into the picture. He put himself in the story. And I want to suggest that what Rembrandt did here is actually a great illustration of discipleship. To insert yourself in the story of Jesus and the 12 and let that story shape and transform you. That's something that sometimes is lost. We frame discipleship in so many different ways, but discipleship is really has a particular referent. And in these lectures, we're going to look at the gospel portrayals of discipleship, looking at it as a paradigm that can serve then as a framework for our modern approach to discipleship. Discipleship is a very prominent term in the Christian tradition, especially in evangelical circles. It's used widely among churchgoers and practitioners and scholars. But the reality is that the pervasive use of the term as a theological and a technical term is really a modern phenomenon. The early church didn't use discipleship as an abstract noun, as something you do. They prefer the term catechesis, or the Latin fathers would use the word disciplina, meaning to discipline in the faith. The term discipleship as a technical term and a theological category, a systematized theological category, only emerged in the 19th and 20th century, particularly with the publication of The Cost of Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer in 1937, which really began to popularize the term, especially in evangelical circles. And then you have organizations like the Navigators, or the discipleship movement, which began to develop a very specific discipleship curriculum, began to describe the practice of what we do with catechesis and teaching. So although the practice of discipleship has been very present in the life of the church throughout the centuries, the term used to reflect that practice has been very fluid and somewhat elastic. The term is used sometimes as a placeholder for several different things that we do. Other times, it's redefined according to the context in which we are. So a rather elastic and fluid concept. It's hard to pin down what it is, if you think about it. My own experience with this term, I think, illustrates this very well. I grew up in Brazil in the 80s and 90s. We used to do one-on-one evangelism in our town. And back then, we used that leaflet, very famous leaflet by the Campus Crusade, the Four Spiritual Laws. How many remember the Four Spiritual Laws? Oh, that's a good group here. So I remember as a teenager sitting next to a total stranger in the park, in the city square, and saying asking the weird question, "Have you ever heard of the Four Spiritual Laws?" Now, there's so much in that scene that feels like a scene from another world, beginning with a teenager sitting next to a stranger. We don't see that anymore. Or even a teenager speaking. That is already weird, isn't it? Unless they work at Chick-fil-A, because I don't know what they do with those kids. They're unnaturally nice at Chick-fil-A. But back then, the experience of sharing the gospel in this way led many, many people to Jesus. And when our leaders explained to us what we were doing, they would say something like, "We're making disciples. We are fulfilling the Great Commission. We are doing discipleship." So discipleship was simply another term for preaching the gospel and leading people to accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior. So making disciples was pragmatically understood basically as leading people to a prayer of confession and then introducing them to a local church. And as I think about it, perhaps at one point or at that point, it was really that simple. Perhaps because it was a time when relationships were stronger in the context of a local church, when relational teaching and accountability ran deeper in the fabric and experience of the community. But things have certainly changed. We can't just assume that someone who said a prayer of confession and is attending our regular services is being discipled. Now, going back to my context in Brazil, as churches began to overflow with converts, we experienced a revival in Brazil in that season. The need for some sort of Christian catechism became obvious. And so the Christian education movement, epitomized in the Sunday school curricula, became normative. And that's how we started using the term discipleship, the task of educating Christians in Bible memorization and Bible study. That was discipleship. And then came the house church movement, very strong in my country, in the home of Christians who are now inviting their neighbors for a more relational experience in their living rooms, became the environment for a more intimate one-to-one small groups initiatives, approaches. And this initiative was often seen as the rediscovery of discipleship. We're now doing discipleship in the way that it should be done in small groups, in the home setting, etc. Then came the spiritual formation movements with the practice of spiritual disciplines. And discipleship became really about practicing the spiritual disciplines. And then came the Christian counseling movement, employing various tools of psychology to help people mature as individuals and as Christians. So the growth, self-edification, the growth of the individual became associated and synonymous with discipleship. So all these movements contribute to the stretching of an already elastic term. And suddenly we have a lot of different things being referred to as discipleship. And part of the reason all these different initiatives quickly appropriated the term is that discipleship is indeed a multivalent concept. It functions in several different ways. And all these different movements emphasize certain aspects, such as gospel proclamation and teaching and relationships and transformation, which are built into the concept of discipleship as a whole. But you see the problem there. The obvious problem is that if discipleship is such an elastic term, it sort of loses its distinctiveness. In other words, if everything is discipleship, nothing is discipleship. Without a referent, the term becomes a label without any real substance. I believe there are three common tendencies towards reductionism when it comes to modern notions of discipleship. First is discipleship reduced to teaching. Now, teaching is a big part of what discipleship entails. The very meaning of the word is associated with learning. But the way that learning happens in the context of discipleship goes beyond our modern understanding of the practice of instruction. Now, obviously, no one would say this out loud, but in practice, we might act as if our instruction, our preaching, our teaching is enough to accomplish discipleship. And part of me wishes it were. I mean, I as a pastor and a seminary professor, I'd like to say that what I do by preaching the Bible every Sunday and teaching my students every week is discipleship. And perhaps it's a form of discipleship, accomplish something along those lines. But saying that my preaching and teaching accomplishes discipleship is certainly a stretch, especially because modern teaching tends to be too unidirectional and content-oriented to really translate the relational, the transformative, and the formational dynamics that characterize genuine discipleship. So discipleship involves teaching, but it's not just teaching or preaching. We can't just say that because we are preaching and teaching the gospel, we are doing discipleship. The second reductionism is to reduce discipleship to strategy and content. And here the tendency is to reduce it to a program or a curriculum. And we gravitate towards those very naturally. We want something we can do and something against which we can measure our success. My hunch is that we take the word make in making disciples and immediately translate it to some sort of manufactured process with a manual. Give me something I can do and something I can understand in a step-by-step procedure so I can know exactly what it is. And yes, you can accomplish discipleship with the use of certain strategies and content, but these are not enough to define what discipleship is beyond the level of tools and instruments. And then my favorite reductionism, well, not my favorite, but the one that really concerns me, is to think of discipleship as a season in the Christian life. So you come to Christ, you say the prayer of confession, and then someone says to you, you have to be discipled. Okay, how does that work? Well, there's this 12-week program course that you take. And in that initial phase, we'll teach you the foundations of the Christian faith. You learn about the Trinity, and you learn about the saving work of Christ. You learn some big words like sanctification and justification. And you learn how the church operates. And then you graduate. We don't say it out loud, but we treat it like that. You've gone through our course, normally sometimes in preparation to baptism or something like that, and then you are officially discipled. You become now a mature Christian, and you can then step level up and then become someone who will serve in the context of ministry and service in the church. Of course, most churches wouldn't doctrinally claim that discipleship ends after a course. Yet, practically, we often treat a new believer's class or a 12-week study as if we had done discipleship for that person. And most dangerously, sometimes we give the person the impression that they have been then discipled. So it becomes a season in the life of the Christian. So we have a context in which discipleship is understood in very pragmatic terms. As an educator, and that those are my basic lenses, so I wonder if inadvertently what we're doing is really transferring the logic of our institutionalized understanding of education and transferring it as progressive learning, right? And transferring it to the Christian life. So we have teaching, we have curriculum, we have a process, and maybe even a graduation at some point. So surely there are more organic models that we see in churches emphasizing community and relationships. But the tendency, and as an outsider, as someone from Brazil, I can say that is really exacerbated both positively and negatively in the context of the American church. The tendency is to turn everything into a pragmatic, reproducible model. It's almost inevitable that what begins as something organic ends up becoming a pragmatic, reproducible model. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with pragmatic approaches, but there is a great risk that in focusing on the pragmatic results of discipleship, we end up distancing ourselves from any tangible, concrete referent. It's a common tendency. We develop methods to accomplish a value, and then the method becomes the value, right? We develop a method to accomplish a value. The value is supposed to be the goal, but then very quickly, the methods become the value. So we have two problems here, which are in some ways paradoxical, really. On the one hand, we stretch discipleship to become anything we can fit under that umbrella. And on the other hand, we restrict discipleship in terms of pragmatic results. So there's both an elasticity to it and a restriction to the problem. Again, in themselves, most of the discipleship initiatives out there are solid and meaningful. And I'm not against methods. The first job that I got after becoming a professor at Gordon Conwell was that they noticed that I talk about discipleship a lot and said, why don't you do discipleship with our students? Well, I needed a program. So I started with that. And that's when I realized, why am I just looking at a program? Why am I just reinventing the wheel? What should we really be doing? So that comes from a sort of a pastoral concern of mine as well, in relation to my students and in relation to congregants in churches. So when we get disconnected from a concrete referent, these methods, these programs, tend to harden into one-dimensional systems. So my goal here in this lecture is really is to, now that we problematize the issue, now that we see that there is perhaps some reductionisms that we have to look at, how can we get some guardrails? What makes discipleship? What is this concrete referent? Is there anything tangible that we can touch and see and look and say, okay, this is discipleship in the Bible? I want to suggest that we should think of discipleship in terms that are anchored more firmly in a scriptural paradigm. We should recover the fuller storied paradigm that serves as a foundation to our various modern and contextualized discipleship approaches. And if we are to ground the concept of discipleship in a biblical theological foundation, there is a very, very clear paradigm that defines the contours of discipleship. And that is Jesus' relationship with the 12 as conveyed in the canonical Gospels. Now, this sounds like a given, right? Discipleship is in the Gospels. But if you think about it, it has tremendous implications. If discipleship is primarily shaped by Jesus' relationship with the 12, then it has a historical referent. And if we intentionally tether ourselves to this referent more firmly, to this historical referent, that referent begins to determine the contours and the shape of our understanding of discipleship. In a sense, this relates to the nature of Christianity itself. Christianity as a religion can easily be understood in terms of dogma or beliefs with some accompanying ethical principles. So things you believe and things that you do as a result of what you believe. And it seems that that's the way that we frame discipleship sometimes. Here are the things that you need to believe, and here are the things you need to do. And for that reason, we sometimes think of discipleship primarily in these terms, to teach people what they need to believe and what they need to do or how they need to live. But it's critical to understand that Christianity does not emerge simply from Jesus' teachings, as if he founded some sort of wisdom tradition. No, the distinct nature about Christianity is that it is a historical claim. At its very essence, Christianity is an event. Christianity is not based on the principles taught by a sage, and it has that sort of wisdom simply determining its essence. No, it's his life, his death, his ministry, his resurrection that constitutes the origins of the Christian movement. It's not simply about the teachings of a master. It's about how these teachings are anchored in the historical reality of his manifestation. We are here today not just because Jesus, as a sage, as a wise man, taught a few things. We are here because of what happened in the middle of history. We're here because something changed the very fabric of reality. And that gives rise to how we understand discipleship. So Christianity is unique because Jesus is unique and because of what we claim happened in the middle of history as a result of his manifestation. So in the same way, when we talk about discipleship, we're not talking simply about teaching or a concept that is subjective in nature. We're talking about a historical paradigm. We're talking about something that happened in history. Discipleship is a concept whose contours are defined by the historical relationship between Jesus and his disciples. And however we define that term, and whatever methods we apply to accomplish discipleship, its contours are inextricably linked to this historical paradigm of discipleship. So there is a frame of reference. There is a historical frame of reference for us to understand what it is. Now, when trying to define discipleship biblically, we run into a few issues. For starters, discipleship as an abstract noun is not found in scriptures. At least not in the same way they define words like salvation or faith or justification. What we find instead is a term mathetes, which means a learner, a disciple, which occurs 266 times in the New Testament. It's a lot, meaning disciple or learner. But the curious thing about this term is that the vast majority of these occurrences The term does not refer to a practice, but to people. To be more precise, a specific group of 12 people with whom Jesus nurtured a relationship. Now, there were other disciples of Jesus as well, but the vast majority of the occurrences of the term refers to Jesus and the 12. So there is a concrete, personal, and relational dimension to discipleship. And whatever adaptations we make, our understanding of discipleship and its practice must stand in continuity with this original source, meaning Jesus and his relationship with his disciples. So we have a particular historical referent, a paradigm, and that paradigm comes to us through a particular medium, the Christian Gospels. And because of that, the nature of the medium, the nature of the Gospels, determines the way that we appropriate the paradigm. In the Gospels, discipleship is enmeshed with the story of Jesus, or to be more precise, with the storied historical account of Jesus, something that happened in history, but it's told in a particular way. As a genre, the Gospels are not propositional discourses, which means that we will not find a discursive explanation of or definition of discipleship. You won't find something like discipleship is. Instead, what we find is a much more complex interweaving of historical, theological, and narrative dimensions that all give shape to what discipleship is. Now, most scholars suggest that although being something of a unique genre, the Gospels are closer to the Greco-Roman biographies, or the bioi. And these works were very interesting. They were works of literature that focused on the lives of certain prominent individuals, and they were meant to recommend these individuals as paradigms of virtue in order to be imitated. People would write these biographies for other people, for common people, to look at these individuals and imitate them. And that itself is relevant to our understanding of discipleship, because a big part of discipleship, as we will see, is imitation. That's the paradigm of learning. So the fact that the Gospels belong with a genre that focuses on virtue and imitation is already important. But although it's certainly true that the Gospels are centered around Jesus and have a biographical nature to them, it's also important to note that the Gospels are not just about Jesus. They're also about the movement that emerged out of the Christ event, which resulted in the birth of the church. So the overall reflection emerging from the Gospels is not only on the identity and mission of Jesus, but how his incarnation, his ministry, his teaching, his death and resurrection gave rise to a community of disciples that continue to exercise his authority on earth and to advance the kingdom he inaugurated. So in that sense, the Gospels are not simply interested in the question, who's Jesus? That's primarily the reason why we read the Gospels, to learn who Jesus is. But there's also an equally important question being addressed in the Gospels, and that is, what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? And those two questions are really intertwined and inseparable in the Gospels. You can't have one without the other. So Jesus' constitution, his training, his commissioning of this initial group of disciples is the very matrix of the church and the very origins of the Christian movement, and therefore a primary concern of the Christian Gospels. Now, also important here for our understanding, I'm just laying the foundation for our approach here, is that the Gospels are historical, theological narratives. So discipleship, if the Gospels are historical theological narratives, discipleship comes to us in these different layers, historical, theological, and narratival layers. So first, the historical dimensions. If history is the fundamental matrix of discipleship, we learn what it is not simply by abstraction, but by observation and imitation. Understanding discipleship is first and foremost understanding the nature of Jesus' paradigmatic relationship with those he first called, taught, and commissioned, and seeking to follow his lead. So we cannot do discipleship without paying close attention to what Jesus was doing with the 12. If history is our fundamental framework, then understanding the context in which Jesus and the 12 operated becomes of fundamental importance. In other words, we have to understand what discipleship meant back then in order to understand what it can mean today. Second, the theological dimensions. Even though the Gospels are histories, they are not simply history. The primary concern of the evangelists was not that of a historian, but that of a theologian, and more specifically, I would say, a pastoral theologian. When it comes to Jesus, the Gospels are not simply interested in a detached, raw portrayal of Jesus, but in a theologically rich portrayal meant to lead people to faith in him. We get that from John 21. So the same way, when we have the drama of the disciples in the Gospels, they're not just telling a story for information purposes only. They are advancing a certain theological reflection about what it means to follow Jesus. These reflections, the story as it is told in the Gospels, they likely had a pastoral and a pedagogical function in the early church. The evangelists meant for these accounts to shape the faith and the lives of those who first read and heard these stories. So the portrayal of the disciples in the Gospels, they create a broader narrative of discipleship. And this narrative was supposed to function as a paradigm for the early Christians to understand their own identity as disciples of Jesus. And so it is for us today. The narrative of the disciples, which includes their successes and their failures, stand not only as a record of what happened in their relationship with Jesus, but also as a theological template that informs any discipleship relationship with Jesus. In other words, their story is our story. It's like Rembrandt painting himself into the boat. That's what we are supposed to do as disciples of Jesus. We have to not simply understand what difference it makes for Jesus to be in my life, but to situate my life into what Jesus is doing in the world, to situate ourselves in the story that he is writing. So finally, the historical theological portrayal is storied. It is through narrative that the picture is formed. Discipleship is fundamentally a narrative. So the question of what it means to be a follower of Jesus is answered primarily in the rich plot line of calling, learning, failure, redemption, and commission that emerges from the narrative of the Gospels. I'll say it again, calling, learning, failure, redemption, and commission. So discipleship in the Gospels is really a narrative. The Gospels are not theological treatises. They are not propositional discourse. They are stories. Stories grounded in history, but told in a particular way. So how do we learn discipleship from Scripture? We learn by paying close attention to the story. Paying close attention to the story. And if discipleship is storied, we can only understand what it is and how to appropriate it in our relationships today if we are immersed in that story. So discipleship entails entering the story of Jesus in the 12 and allowing that story to shape our own stories with Jesus and with one another. So what we'll do in the remainder of this lecture is to focus on some of the historical elements to have a historical framework to understand what discipleship meant back then in the times of Jesus. And then in the next lecture, we're going to look at two theological elements that come through the story. Again, this is a journey into the world of the New Testament. And I think it is sort of a different approach to what we typically do when talking about discipleship. We begin with our very pragmatic tasks before us. How do I deal with that people, that person in front of me that needs to learn how to grow in the faith? But what I wanted to encourage you to do is to kind of journey with me through this world of the New Testament and try to understand what it meant for these people to be called by Jesus back then and to walk with Jesus back then. And maybe that will create a framework for us to understand and carry out our task in a better way. So let's begin with history then. When it comes to history, the question we have to ask is, what did the evangelists have in mind when they described the relationship between Jesus and the 12 as a relationship between the master and his disciples? So the question, this historical question, helps us understand a few things. It helps us understand how similar was Jesus' approach to discipleship to other ways of doing discipleship in his time, but also how different it was by virtue of the uniqueness of the Christ event, how different it was in relation to these other models. And thirdly, it helps us in the modern world to understand how different Jesus' relationship with the 12, Jesus' approach to discipleship, is from what we might be doing today. So the origins of discipleship then. In one sense, Jesus did not invent discipleship in one sense. Jesus resignified discipleship. The Greek word mathetes comes from the verb manthano, which means to gain knowledge or a skill by instruction, to learn. So in its most basic sense, the disciple is a learner, an apprentice. So if someone would teach someone kind of an artisan skill, that person would be a disciple in a more raw kind of sense. But the word disciple also carries a more specialized, almost technical sense in some contexts, namely that of an adherent, someone who embraces the worldview, the culture, and the customs of a leader or a group. So a disciple is a learner, yes, but more than a learner who learns a skill, it's someone who embraces a whole worldview. We're going to talk a lot about identity here as it relates to discipleship. In terms of the Old Testament, there are a few words in Hebrew that translate the discipleship, like Talmid or Limud. Both are related to the Greek word here, but they're somewhat rare in the Hebrew Bible. What we have, however, in the Hebrew Bible is the roots of discipleship, the dynamics of discipleship, which are very much present in the Old Testament in the instruction ethos of the family and the communal life of Israel. One may think, for example, of Deuteronomy 6:6-9, where parents were supposed to teach their children diligently Yahweh's commandments in the course of everyday activities, such as walking on the way or while sitting in the house. This model of instruction, in which you have the integration, and this is key for the ethos of discipleship, the integration of teaching and life. The integration of teaching and life. That would certainly have spread to other social circles as well. So discipleship really in the Bible begins in the context of the family, in this relational instructional dynamics. And the reason it was clear, that it was this notion that one needs to be instructed in the fear of the Lord and pass it on to the next generation. So although the typical discipleship terminology is not in the Old Testament, one might say that the dynamics of discipleship, which were later formalized in Judaism in terms of a master-disciple relationship, has its root in this very prominent Israelite practice of instruction, of walking with your son or your daughter and teaching them in the context of the way, in the setting of the table, in the middle of life, not as something you do separately as an appendix or a certain moment, but something that is integrated in life. So the model of a parent, a child, the instructional model of relational teaching that brings together everyday life and Torah was precisely the basis of discipleship dynamics that we see later in Judaism. So at its very core, discipleship finds its essential model in the context of the family and communal relationships. How many of us think of parenting as discipleship? Well, that's really what you're doing, right? Walking on the way, driving around with your kid, having conversations at the table. That's the most dynamic and seamless context for discipleship to happen. So in many ways, the recovery of discipleship is the recovery of the family dynamics of a relational instruction. So perhaps one thing that we should think in pragmatic terms is how to help our parents to become disciplers. How to help the family to step in that role and not just, you know, outsource that for the professionals in the church. But I'm getting sort of ahead of myself here. So, the family. Now, when it comes to points of comparison, and here we're going to go a little deeper in the weeds here with history, there were certain groups that practiced discipleship in the times of Jesus. And the purpose of looking at them is really to see what are the common elements that emerge out of this practice. Among the Greek philosophers, the mathetes, the disciple, was a primary term for a learner attached to a famous teacher, but there were various models in the Greco-Roman setting. In the Sophist movement, disciples were usually wealthy students paying high fees for elite training. So this, in some contexts, was really restricted to people who had a lot of resources, because there was a lot of gravitas that came with being discipled by a certain prominent philosopher. But then came Socrates and Plato and others who treated philosophy as a gift to be shared with rich and poor alike and found schools like Epicurus' Garden and Plato's Academy. And these schools, they combined academic studies, the study of rhetoric, of poetry, mathematics, astronomy, politics, but they combined that with relational learning and friendship. So that teaching was integrated with shared life. Another kind of setting where that happened, the context of friendship. It's interesting that even Plato and others would resist the term mathetes, the term disciple, because it had elitist connotations, and they use instead the word hetaidos, which means friend, to kind of bring a more relational and egalitarian perception to discipleship. The goal of discipleship in this philosophical framework was what the Greeks called eudaimonia, or happiness, or human flourishing, which was only to be attained by developing virtue. So it was really a journey of self-improvement, of personal self-improvement. And here is precisely where we see a distinction, a sharp contrast with the Jewish understanding of discipleship. In Second Temple Judaism, in especially in Palestinian Judaism, the background of the concept of discipleship is reflected primarily in two main groups. First is the Qumran community. Very quirky kind of people. They took the prophecy of Isaiah 40, prepare the way in the wilderness for the Lord, very seriously and literally, and moved to the wilderness and lived as a closed sectarian community with an eschatological orientation. They believed that by studying Torah in community, in a closed community, they were preparing themselves for the arrival of the Messiah, for an incredible thing that God will do in the history of Israel. So although there were different aspects to this preparation in the wilderness, teaching was a predominant task. They saw themselves as an eschatological fellowship of learners. They called themselves disciples of God. So this group was very interesting. They were organized around a figure called the Teacher of Righteousness. So there was a predominant figure there, and they had a rigorous process of admission into the communities. It was not very easy to get in. Teaching was very communal, was very structured, was very formalized. much like the dynamics of the Greco-Roman philosophical schools, but they were much more sectarian in their nature and eschatological in their orientation. They were always aiming at something future-oriented, something that was about to happen. They were preparing themselves. Teaching was not just self-improvement. They were preparing themselves for something that God was about to do. That's Qumran. The other group was the rabbinic schools, which originated during the exile, when Torah study became central to Israel's identity. And then in that context, the scribe and later the rabbis established schools to transmit the oral traditions developed from the interpretation of the law. And in this context, the Talmidim, the disciples, were really essential to preserve the tradition and to perpetuate the tradition. So there was this charge in the Mishnah, the record of the traditions of the rabbis, that has a command to the rabbis, raise up many disciples. Becoming a Talmid, becoming a disciple, was a great honor. Students would travel long distances and lived for extended periods with a recognized teacher, learning under their authority. Instruction in this context was oral, very focused on speech. It was relational, and fundamentally it was imitative. Disciples sat at their rabbi's feet, absorbing both his teaching and, most importantly, his embodied way of life. So this learning was really show and tell, right? It's really showing how to live by living with someone. Learning was communal as well. Students were supposed to find fellow disciples and grow within a shared community. But the ultimate goal, different from the Greco-Roman setting, the ultimate goal was not just personal advancement. It was the strengthening of Israel as a whole. Both Qumran and Rabbinic Judaism saw discipleship as serving God's purpose for his people, not merely self-improvement. It was not just about becoming a better Jew. It was not just about becoming a better person or finding some sort of happiness in life. No, it was about aligning yourself with what God was doing in the world, with the purposes of God in the world. So we see here really a few elements emerging from that paradigm. First, identity. There was this profound sense of identity involved in being a disciple in these groups. In all these contexts, discipleship entails some form of abandonment of a previous commitment in order to become an affiliate of the master or the school. So discipleship was absolutely disruptive. It was something that would reshape the entire existence of the individual. They would reorganize their entire life around the purpose and the task of being discipled. The student was supposed to embrace the values and the lifestyle of the group, which implied a significant reprioritization, or in some cases even a break with their existing loyalty. So discipleship was really disruptive. Becoming a disciple entailed a decisive move away from certain social contexts in order to embrace the worldview of a group, at least in these contexts that we're talking about. To become a disciple was a big deal. It was not a 10-step program or curriculum. It was embracing a new life, which came at the cost of rejecting prior allegiances. It was a matter of a new identity. Now, generally speaking, this was a process initiated by the candidate, never the teacher. So rabbis would not call, typically, would not call disciples. Disciples would come to the rabbi and say, can I follow you? Can I adopt your way of life? So there was a great deal of personal investment in discipleship. Also, it was a demanding process envisioning transformation. The process of training and education was demanding in all cases, with a view towards moral and intellectual transformation. So getting into one of these groups could be more or less difficult depending on the tradition. But once you're in, once the candidate was part of the group, the training itself was rigorous and required an enormous diligence. There was a cost, a real cost to discipleship. This was the case because in both Greco-Roman and Jewish circles, it was not just there was a lot at stake. Discipleship served as a means of preserving and transmitting a living tradition. Third, it was all about learning by imitation. In all traditions, the content of the teaching itself was of fundamental importance, of ultimate value, but the role of the teacher was so important that for the purposes of learning, you cannot separate the teaching from the teacher. You learn the teaching, but you learn the teacher. You learn from his demeanor. You learn from the way that he conducts himself in life. So the student was supposed to spend time emulating the master. So imitation was a primary means of learning. And finally, learning happened in community. In all these traditions, although the disciples' primary relationship was with their masters, learning was a communal experience. And being a communal experience, it had two sides to it. The first is this corporate identity that became very sectarian. So once you were part of these groups, you were in and you shut everybody out. So there was a very exclusivistic ethos. But the other side of this sectarianism was a strong sense of belonging. Being a disciple was being part of a community, being part of something bigger, which was, of course, one of the greatest appeal. So, when we look at Jesus' discipleship then, well, we certainly see some continuity and enough similarities with these practices for the relationship between Jesus and the 12 to be called discipleship. For example, being a disciple of Jesus also entailed the abandonment of a certain context in order to embrace a new worldview and a new lifestyle. So it was a fundamental matter of identity. Similarly, Jesus' discipleship was also costly. It was demanding and envisioned transformation. Jesus' teaching on the kingdom of God was a central focus of his discipleship, but as in the case of the groups that we just mentioned, his teaching was enmeshed with his own person. The goal of the disciples was to imitate Jesus. And finally, Jesus also formed a community in which discipleship was experienced in fellowship. So Jesus' discipleship model carries the same overall contours of its contemporary counterparts, which explains why people would say this is a discipleship relationship, what Jesus would call his disciples, disciples. So this comparison is already illuminating as a point of contrast with our modern understanding of the practice of making disciples. There was a particular ethos, someone joining a group intentionally, someone embracing a new identity, someone investing their lives, someone following and imitating a master, someone involved in a larger community with a bigger purpose. That was the ethos of discipleship. Now, when we look at what we do, how distinctive that is in relation to this paradigm. But there are also ways in which Jesus deepened and resignified discipleship, even in relation to these models. First, and just amazing really, Jesus' initiative and his calling. Unlike the other voluntary associations or rabbinic schools, discipleship with Jesus began not with the disciples' initiative, but with Jesus' authoritative call. It was a phenomenal experience. The calling narratives in the Gospels describe a critical moment when Jesus interrupts the daily lives, the daily activities of certain individuals, and then calls them to follow him. It's more than an invitation, as we normally frame it. It is an authoritative calling that flows out of the display of his divine authority. Only Jesus can call in this way. Now, the other thing that is interesting here is while these other Jewish associations like Qumran or the rabbinic schools, by virtue of the voluntary nature, would attract candidates that were preparing, their whole lives to become disciples. They were studying Torah. They had certain qualifications. Well, not Jesus. Jesus calls ordinary people with no prior qualifications whatsoever or religious ambitions whatsoever. A very, very different paradigm. You wouldn't go around looking for fishermen to accomplish the most important eschatological task in history. You simply don't. You go to the synagogue. You look for those who are studying. You go to the seminary. But no, Jesus calls people with no prior qualification, no religious ambitions, fishermen, tax collectors, and others excluded from formal training. Their response stemmed not from their pursuit of a teacher, but from the compelling power of Jesus' own call. So discipleship really begins with the call, with the calling. And I don't know what that, how that translates to in practical terms, but there's certainly a need for us to create environments and spaces where people who experience that call will feel that they're not just adding some element to their lives, but really entering a story, entering a dimension that is that really resignifies their lives. The second difference here is the nature of the demand. Now, the rigorous demands of discipleship in contemporary models usually have to do with the study and the conduct. And in Jesus' discipleship, the demands were of a very different nature. Rather than readiness and excellence in relation to the knowledge of Torah, Jesus' demands in the gospel are framed in more radical terms associated with suffering, with self-denial, with persecution. These unique demands are related to the specific emphasis of Jesus' ministry, which is determined by his suffering at the cross. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the second lecture. But in terms of imitation as a discipleship method, the disciples were supposed to replicate Jesus' servanthood and intentionally learn from his actions. But beyond just ethics, they were to imitate Jesus in his cruciform mission. So discipleship was profoundly associated with Jesus' suffering. Disciples were required to take up their cross and follow after Jesus. They were to expect persecution simply by virtue of being followers of Jesus. So imitation in suffering determined the very shape of discipleship. So brought to incredibly high standards. Third, inaugurated and embodied eschatology. And here I bring the big words that Ken was talking about, and I'll explain them, especially in the second lecture. But while Jesus likely taught Torah to his disciples, as other rabbis did, his instruction was centered on the manifestation of the kingdom of God through him. In other words, the announcement that Yahweh's long-awaited intervention was unfolding through his person. The only reason Jesus calls disciples in Mark is because of what he says before he calls them. The kingdom of God has come. Repent and believe in the gospel. So Jesus embodied the eschatological fulfillment of Yahweh's promises, making discipleship an active participation in the very disclosure of God's kingdom through his person. So being a disciple of Jesus had a sense of eschatological urgency. There's something happening here, and we are part of it. There's a bigger sense. It was not just ethical and moral development. It was there's something that we are being prepared for. There's something that we are participating in that makes sense of our whole life, and not only our lives, but what God is doing in the world. And in terms of the missional community, yes, Jesus, like the rabbis and like the Qumran community, had a community and shaped his group as his discipleship as a communal experience. But Jesus added a strong missional dimension to it. Now, it's interesting that we see in Mark indications that the disciples struggled with exclusivistic and sectarian tendencies. They wanted to be a closed group, just like the rabbis were, and just like the groups in Qumran. But Jesus constantly pushed them to a missional engagement with outsiders. As disciples, they were taught to reach out to the outcast, whether it's a Gentile or poor or Samaritan or marginalized, and they were commissioned to make disciples of all nations. So it was a profoundly communal activity, but also missional, a missional community, an inviting community, a community that went on transforming the spaces in which they were by bringing people into their fold. So although Jesus' discipleship model would promptly fit with the contemporary models of his days, the concept of discipleship emerging from the Gospels acquires specialized meaning, a meaning that is aligned with this unique claims of Jesus and his followers. The meaning of discipleship for Jesus' community follow their understanding of Jesus' unique identity. There's a very interesting moment in the Gospel of Mark, which I think is the emblematic discipleship moment in the narrative. They are in Caesarea Philippi, and Jesus asks the disciples, who do you say that I am? Now, the sequence shows how the particular understanding of Jesus' identity determines the very nature of discipleship. You tell me who you're following, and I'll tell you what kind of disciple you are. You tell me who Jesus is, and I'll tell you what kind of disciple you are. And his identity is associated with his suffering. In the same exchange, Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let them deny themselves, take up his cross, and follow me. So his identity, as shaped by his cruciform mission, is what informs discipleship. And we're going to expand that on that on the second lecture. But here's the takeaway from this one. Why is this whole historical comparison important? Well, when we look at what Jesus is doing with the 12, we notice that although there were similarities with contemporary paradigms, discipleship in Jesus' model was unique and was uniquely determined by the uniqueness of Jesus. So, yes, Jesus would be called a rabbi, and he was. His general teaching style would involve instruction and imitation. Some might look at him and hear his teaching and say, that sounds a lot like Qumran, or this looks like a lot like rabbinic midrash. It looks like rabbinic teaching. Yeah, this is discipleship. But because of the uniqueness of Jesus' self-disclosure and the eschatological mission that he brings, discipleship was something different altogether. There was even, one might say, a weirdness about it. It's somewhat weird what Jesus is doing with the 12. A weirdness that would be recognized by those familiar with other models of discipleship. And I think there is an important reflection for us here. It seems to me that a big temptation when it comes to modern discipleship is that in the desire for contextualization, for relevance, and for validation, we end up framing Christian discipleship in the popular frameworks available for us in the culture, whether it's the leadership paradigm or the psychological paradigm or the coaching or the mentoring frameworks. And we end up adjusting ourselves to these frameworks, importing those and calling it discipleship. Now, as was the case with Jesus' discipleship, there will be points of contact with the culture, and those elements, those methods, those strategies can be used to a certain extent. People will look at what we do and say, well, that looks a lot like this, or that looks a lot like that. But the risk is to lose our uniqueness, to lose our weirdness, so to speak. There is a uniqueness to Christian discipleship that will sometimes feel strange for the contemporary culture. It should feel strange. That's part of why it works. So the challenge is to recapture the unique elements of Christian discipleship established by the gospel paradigm and recover its meaning in our modern application of the paradigm. In conclusion, then, discipleship is a distinct paradigm in Scripture, a paradigm that comes to us in the history, theology, and narrative of the Gospels. And whatever we do with discipleship, it needs to retain its essential gospel-shaped nature. We can only contextualize what we understand. We can only contextualize what we understand. So in the next section, we will explore in more detail two specific theological dimensions of this paradigm, the covenantal eschatological emphasis and the cruciform emphasis, and hopefully understand how weird but also wonderful that is. Thank you.
All right, great stuff from part one, and I promise he's going to dive even deeper in the next episode. Part two of this talk is available as a separate episode right now. Listen wherever you're getting this podcast.